Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I'm an SFB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Justin Meinhardt joins me to talk guest every Thursday night starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444 to follow the directions. The call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to Talk's website at www.talkshoe.com and search for call ID 17702 or Starfleet Universe On Call or SFU On Call. In any of those cases, you should be able to find us. Now, of course, for the best online experience, you have to go to twitch.tv. Yes, twitch.tv/SFUOnCall. And you will find us there and be able to join the chat room and just have a good time, you know, every single Thursday night. And of course, you need to contact me for any reason. My email address is SFUOnCall@gmail.com. That's SFUONCALL@gmail.com. Also, if you want to, you can follow me on Twitter at SFUOnCall. Also, my personal account on there is Paul Franz, PAUFRANZ. There is no T in that. And Franz Games, FRANZGMES. Again, no T. And of course, a lovely podcast gets into the podcast available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Some quick news from A to B this week. A to B actually moved hosting providers due to Future Quest going closing their doors. So they did that actually this week. And just a reminder of one thing that happened with the discussion board is that when they locked it down. Well, the problem is 6 days prior is what they've got. They don't have all of the messages. So they lost like 6 days of messages. So if you had posted anything in the past week, then I would recommend you might need to actually repost it. When it comes to the online store, sorry, nothing for this week. I'm just running short on time. When it comes to online client, there's actually nothing happening this week, though. I definitely have to get to an email from Jeff about some different things that need to be either worked on, fixed, or otherwise improved. And also when it comes to the library report, both FedCom and SFB libraries have had no progress whatsoever. But when it comes to SFB Online Tournament, Sapphire Star Tournament, we have round one, it's completed. Round three is almost completed. I just have to get my game done against Stephen McCann, and then we should have that completed and moved on to the semi-final round. I think I got that right. No, it'd be the finals. Yeah, it'd be finals. I'm right now. This is the semifinal round, which is four. No, that'd be the semifinal round is next round because there's two games, and then it goes into a single game. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm confused. So with that is the news for this week. And it's me, it's the one and only Paul Franz, welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, well, we have the whole gang here. Well, only one other person we could have, but he hasn't been available lately, which is Barry. But we'll start with Gary. How you doing, Gary?
Hello.
How you doing? Wonderful day.
Well, I guess. I'll wait until the intro's everyone's done.
Okay. And we should go this all the way down. Okay, cool. And of course we have Jeff. How you doing, Jeff?
Good evening, everyone. It's a beautiful evening in Boise, Idaho tonight.
All the way out west. I'm sure it's cooler than it is out here.
It was 95 on my dash when I pulled out of when I walked to the restaurant.
Wow. That's definitely warmer than here. It only got up to like 90, 92, I think, today. And we have Doug. How you doing, Doug?
I am here. How are you guys doing tonight? Not melting too much out there?
So apparently Dorothy is being a slacker. None of us are melting.
What? No tornadoes.
Well, I think we had enough rain out here, though. You know. Yeah, and one day we got between 5 and 8 inches of rain. Oh, yeah, yay. That was crazy.
I don't doubt it.
Yep. But anywho, what we're going to do is the topic I had planned for this evening kind of got canned. I ran out of time to do things this evening to finish everything off that I needed to finish off. So we're going to revisit a previous topic, which is not that long ago, only two weeks ago, which is Tholian Celtorians in the Omega Octant. Did I got that right, Gary?
Sorry. Yeah. Although I just want to do a bit of a couple of quick mentions before we get started. One is, I don't know if anyone saw the news, but Manny Coto, he was the showrunner for season 4 of Star Trek Enterprise, i.e. the good season. He passed away sadly a few days ago.
Oh.
And he was the age of 62. So, relatively young, but good fortune. But he was the one who really turned the thing around. Unfortunately, it's too late for the show, but he was the one who finally made it more prequelier in terms of, like, you know, introducing story arcs that were involving the Vulcans, Andorians, and the kind of the pre-Federation stuff. Mm-hmm. Because the network had made the showrunners not focus on that initially. Like, they threw on all this temporal stuff because were afraid that not enough people would tune in for the actual prequel stuff. But then by the time Manny got his hands on the show, I guess it didn't matter as much, whatever. But nonetheless, not to take away from the work that he and others put in to actually make that the most memorable season. So, so to mention that. And also, tonight is the inaugural night for Major League Cricket. So cricket is basically the other big bat and ball game around the world. It's actually bigger than baseball in terms of raw numbers, but the distribution is very different. Like, there's very few countries that are into both baseball and cricket equally. But nonetheless, this new system, league, it's got six teams. They're all ostensibly based around the US, but they're for the most part, they're road teams because the only stadium that's ready to go is a converted baseball park that's in Grand Prairie, Texas. So the inaugural match is happening there, I guess, as we speak. And there's over $100 million that's been invested in this thing because there's a lot of, I think one of the guys involved with Microsoft, I think, is an investor in the Seattle team, for example. So they're going to build somewhere in Washington State, they're going to build a dedicated cricket ground for that team. And they're doing similar things in other cities. But it's only just beginning, but time will tell whether there'll be any expansion teams, or for that matter, if they'll do what most other major leagues do and introduce Canadian teams like Toronto or Vancouver or whatever. Because on this side of the border, there's certainly interest in the sport. In fact, the oldest cricket ground, I think, in Toronto, the cricket club in Toronto has been there since 1824. But time will tell. I mean, because I guess if people who are more familiar with baseball want to see what baseball's closest living cousin is like, then at least if they want to see the T20 version, which is about 3 hours per match, then now's their chance to actually go to it in person if they're near Grand Prairie, Texas, I guess.
How long are the test matches? Is it single day or is it 3 day or what?
Well, it's not going to be test cricket. It's going to be 2020, which is about 3 hours per game.
Oh, okay. Okay, so the different kind of cricket, I guess you could say.
Yeah, a full-on test match takes about 5 days, and ODIs take 1 day, and one day internationals, but the 2020 cricket takes about 3 hours on average. But each country, there's only 12 countries that are ranked high enough in the cricket, in terms of the International Cricket Councils or rating of them, that say that the game is established enough for them to be test nations. So the majority of countries that have any sort of cricket team, they're most likely just playing 2020. Although in fairness, 2020 is the most lucrative version of it because the world's biggest cricket league is in India. And actually, it's no coincidence that at least four of the six teams in the Major League Cricket have Indian backing. So for example, the New York team is called MI New York, and the MI stands for Mumbai Indians. Although unlike the Cleveland team, which is now the Cleveland Guardians, the Indians in Mumbai Indians refers to actual India Indians. not miss confuse Europeans confusing Native Americans for people from another part of the world.
Right.
But yeah, so the only thing is that ironically enough,
as if cricket itself wasn't confusing enough.
Actually being shown. Well, I mean,
I don't think it's that confusing for what I've seen.
True enough.
There's a lot of more established cricket nations where Major League Cricket is actually being broadcast over the air, or at least through an established cable system, whereas in Canada and the US, it's actually being shown only on. There's an app that's called Willow, and it's not to do with the Disney's Willow. It's a separate Willow, but I think all the bats are made from Willow. Or is it the in wickets? Something to do with cricket is made from Willow. But anyway, so that app is already being used for other international cricket things. And I think some of the owners are also involved in the ownership group of MLC. So not coincidentally, they decided that they'd use their own app to broadcast the games. But I think it's unfortunate because it would have been nice even just to know need to help people get up and running with it if they had basically done a kind of like maybe one match a week or one match every 2 weeks, whatever. It's only a relatively short season anyway to start off with. But just to kind of like give people a taste of what the game is like in North America.
Right.
So that some momentum could get built outside of the communities of expats from countries like India and the Trinidad and so forth that already are well familiar with the game. Time will tell.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Well, as it is, we're talking about not as well-known sports in America. Obviously, MLS started small, and actually it's pretty well. It's much better known than it wasn't when it first started out. So I think definitely cricket has a chance to capture some mind and hearts in America.
Well, the trick would be to get the grounds built because you need large enough ovals to be able to play it. So there are some pre-existing grounds in both the US and Canada that are cricket-esque, but some of them are in states or provinces that don't have teams yet. So that's why at least four or five of the MLC teams are getting entirely new ballparks, cricket grounds. And the one in Grand Prairie, actually the ribbon cutting ceremony at Grand Prairie only took place on Tuesday. Like, it was really all hands on deck to get the stadium ready for tonight's opening match. So I'm not too sure where on YouTube the official channel is, because I guess there's all sorts of channels pretending that they're them. But in any case, the league's own website has a video portion, so I'm sure this time tomorrow there'll be a highlight reel of the opening match so people can get a sense of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing is that I personally kind of think that, because right now with 2020, the idea is that one team does all their runs and then the other team has to try to do all their runs to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like in baseball where you have the top and bottom of each inning over nine innings. So I almost wonder if there's a way that you could split the difference where you could actually have a variant of cricket where you are going back and forth, similar to how you do in baseball.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure the purists would be even more upset than they are. Some of the purists, they only accept the five-day test as real cricket. But the thing is for them is that without 2020, cricket would have gone bankrupt in certain parts of the world. So 2020 is a part of the game for good or ill. So.
Mm-hmm.
But, I guess it's... I can't really think of a baseball equivalent in terms of those... Maybe... I don't know. I mean, I guess some of the purists who don't like the designated hit rule, they've still got Japan Central League to support that, but most other leagues, including the National League, have kind of caved in and, gone for the DH at this point. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, agreed. And in theory, it's a little bit of a stretch. You almost could think of a 5-day test match as a baseball series. Because invariably in baseball, you play a series of three games when you're visiting another team. And you know, usually it's a 3-game series. So, you know, that's, I can think it's kind of comparable, but not quite the same, because I understand that if you win the test match, that you've won it, you know, won that one, quote unquote, one match, versus in the case of baseball, you might win 1-0 from 0 to 3 games, you know, as part of a series, possibly even 4 if it's a longer series, or 2 if it's a shorter. But yeah. Anyway.
So one final cricket-related thing before we move on to the topic of the night. It's actually funny because when I in Ireland, there was actually a time for, I think, sort of 50 or 60 years where, because Ireland has its own native Gaelic games, Gaelic football and hurling,
mm-hmm.
and the association was formed before Irish independence. So it saw itself as very opposed to games that were based in England. So like soccer, rugby, cricket, and so forth. They were referred to as quote-unquote garrison games, like games that the British soldiers in Ireland would play. And so, you know, so basically what happened is that for decades, there were actually rules on the statute books for the GAA that said that not only could Gaelic grounds not be used for quote-unquote garrison games, they could be used for American sports. Like there was times when American football players would come over and they would play in Croke Park, like the biggest Irish ground, whatever. But a soccer game couldn't be held there, even if it was an Irish team playing. And on the other hand, if you were a Gaelic footballer or a hurler, like an actual member of the GAA, there was a long time where you were barred from playing the garrison sports as well. Like you could go to Australia and you could play Australian rules because that wasn't seen as the same thing. But if you started playing soccer, you could be kicked out. You wouldn't be allowed to play the Gaelic football or hurling again. So it wasn't until, I think, around the 80s or 90s, like during the time of the Northern Ireland peace process, the GAA basically kind of, you know, it made steps to open the sport up, you know, to try to, you know, be more reconciliatory in the spirit of the time. So now those rules don't exist anymore. People can, you know, like there are some sports, like there was actually a time when Dublin's main soccer and rugby stadium had been pulled down and a new one was being built. And in the intervening period, a couple of the matches that were scheduled for that park were held at the bigger Gaelic ground. And things went better than expected.
Mm-hmm.
And also the likes of cricket and so forth, whatever, where for a long time, cricket had almost no presence, at least in the Republic. Northern Ireland's a different story. It actually has grown as a sport to the point where Ireland is now one of the 12 test nations. And, I mean, even just a few decades ago, no one would have believed you if you'd said Ireland's going to be a test cricket nation. But now it's become an established sport. Like, not the biggest sport by any means, but an established one to keep itself going, ticking along nicely.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting side note. But it also is a promising one in the sense that in Canada and the U.S., cricket has never had that kind of, you know, cultural hang-up. But it's also a reminder that it doesn't have to become the biggest league in either country to be successful. It just has to basically reach the point, both financially and, I guess, competitively, that it's self-sustaining. And that should be enough, at least for now. So, yeah, I guess to any incipient cricket fans out there who, for some reason, are listening to this podcast, hopefully things work out. So.
Agreed.
Why don't we get back to Starfleet University?
I'll catch my breath. Yep. I was about to, but although maybe they play cricket in the Federal Republic of Aurora, maybe they have a big Aurora cricket ground, and they invite the Leishron ambassador to send his best team to play, whatever. But in all seriousness, I was actually, I don't know, because you might be mentioning in the news portion about ADB's relocating to a new server. And part of that relocation involved losing about a week or two's worth of BBS posts.
Yeah, 6 days.
So if anyone has posted anything. Sorry, huh?
Yeah, just,
it was 6 days.
6 days worth. is what Dumb Gene said.
It was pinned down. It was 6 days.
Okay. So now, if anyone has posted anything within that time and has lost it, they might want to have a look and see if they need to repost it. But in any case, fortunately, the topic we're going to talk about wasn't affected because, sadly, no one's posted there. So
hey, there's the benefit there.
That's one way of looking at it.
So, yeah. So, okay. All right. So I wanted to approach the whole Thorian and Sartorian thing in two ways. One is to kind of dig around at the F&E level in terms of what can be made to exist in terms of like ships and bases and so on. And also the tactical aspect in terms of like how effective would the resulting ships be in this new environment compared to what people are used to in Alpha or in M81 for that matter. So my most recent posts in the discussion thread, I was basically digging around the rule books for, because the Tholians are in the standard rule set for F&E, and the Sartorians are one of the three factions introduced in F&E Minor Empires.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have either of those, Paul?
No. I think I have the F&E, the standard, the basic rule book, but I definitely don't have the F&E on the minor, minor empires.
Okay. Well, minor empires comes with a lot of deets about the Sartorians and also about the Vudar and the Liren Democratic Republic. And the Sartorian stuff goes into a lot of information in terms of the what the Sartorians can or can't do based on the technology available. And also, if you have like an ultimate scenario or say you have a nest ship instead of a hive ship, what does that mean in terms of your production capacity? So, because of course the nest ship is smaller, so you can't build as much. And there's also all this other stuff in terms of what the hive ship or nest ship can do, aside from just being a shipyard. Like, what other capacities does it have?
Right.
So, and one other key thing is how fast it is, because I don't have the PDF open in front of me, but I recall something to the effect that the hive ship can only move like one hex a turn. So it's not quite as immobile as the sphere would be when it goes through the barrier, but it's not going anywhere anytime soon because you need to stop at a planet that you can turn into your base planet to really do anything. And so if you're only moving one hex a turn, the more you move, the more you're delaying your ability to actually defend yourself. So I suppose in the alternate, contingency that the Sigvarians take over the Sartorians, like early when they come through, even the Sigvarians are not going to be able to move anytime soon because they also need to start the process of building an empire to survive. Because the hive ship by itself won't cut it. The way I would say it is that there's three categories of things that would be involved here. Category one are things that the Sartorians already know what to build. So they already know how to build the booms and the secondary hull engines in order to, hull sections, in order to create things like heavy cruisers and destroyers and so on. And they already have the blueprints for dreadnoughts and stuff back in the home galaxy. They just need the shipyard to be able to build them. And the second category are things that once they know exist, they know how to build, they can figure out how to reverse engineer the concept. So say, for example, a survey cruiser doesn't really need anything new in terms of technology. It's more of a doctrinal issue. Now, historically, they never bothered building one because they didn't need one back in the home galaxy.
Right.
And there was no real room for one on the production schedule in Alpha. But in principle, if they do land in that area of Omega that is like unchanged space, maybe they might do with a survey cruiser or two to help figure out what resources are available to them.
Agreed. Agreed. So if they have larger space to deal with, then yeah, that definitely would be something that they'd want to create to expand. I was gonna say their influence, but not really their influence. More of to see what kind of resources are available, versus when they were landing the Alpha Octant, a lot of the resources were provided for by the Klingons. It's like, oh, yeah, we got a nice, nice planets over here and so forth. You can use the resources from those, and you're good to go. So there's no reason to create survey cruisers that when it comes to when they land in an Alpha Octant, when they're all they want to do is just kill the Tholians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're right over there. Again.
Now, the third category would be units that historically they needed Klingon help to build. And those would be things like the three boom ships, like the New Light Cruiser or the Light Dreadnought. Because historically, the Sultorians didn't have the computing power to be able to do the balance studies needed to be able to make the warp field dynamics work or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it was the Klingons who basically used their supercomputers to do the engineering studies and say, here's the blueprint to build like the three boom ships. And so there's a kind of a capacity issue that you need a client, you need basically a host empire to be willing to do that for you. And if you don't have that, then you're probably not going to be able to do it, because I don't think a mercenary faction like, say, the Zosmans or the Belasco, I don't think they're going to be in a position, even if they could, I don't think they're going to want to help you in that way. Like, you need like a bigger power that's hosting you to be able to spare the resources necessary.
So right. And
that's another thing that's going to be an impact for
you. And the one thing I was going to mention about having a larger empire that is kind of act as host is that empire also would have to look to see there's a benefit. Obviously, for the Klingons, there was a big benefit for having Sultorians, because they're willing to just go after the Tholians, and that's less ships that the Klingons have to create themselves, and just let the fanatical Sultorians go after the Tholians. Versus in the Omega Octant, what will be their motivation to actually help the Sultorians at all, and not just wipe them from existence? There has to be a benefit to the host nation or empire, sorry.
Yes. So that's why in this circumstance, let's say we start off, let's say for tonight's discussion, at least, let's assume that we're talking about the Eastern scenario, where there's no host empire, but the Sultorians are doing it by themselves.
Right.
Or at the very least, they're maybe hiring mercenaries. Like, maybe they'll hire like fighter pilots from the Iridani or Belasco or Zosmans or whatever. So that means that the way the rules are written, at least off the top of my head, is that once you establish a base planet, you as a Sultorian player can begin the process of disassemble, because the Hive ship, it turns out, well, according to F&E anyway, the Hive ship basically enters the galaxy with a bunch of prefabricated components needed to build a separate shipyard. And so what would happen is that once you get your base planet designated, you can take out those components and start assembling them into a new yard. And near the back of the Minor Empires rulebook, there's actually a list of the additional shipyard capacity that gives you. So, but it also takes about 4 consecutive turns, so about 2 years overall, to complete this yard. And while you're doing that, the Hive ship itself, because the Hive ship acts in certain ways as a tug, because in F&E there are certain tug functions that go by different letters, whatever, and they let you do things like set up mobile bases or act as a supply point,
right,
or do XYZ or whatever. So in this instance, you have to set the Hive ship to a certain tug mission, I think it's mission Z or whatever, for the duration of you building that shipyard. And once you're complete, then you're not able to build any bigger ships, because the transportable shipyard is no bigger in terms of the capacity than the hive ship itself. But what you can then do is spend the next six consecutive turns after that. You pay economic points this time to build a medium-sized shipyard. And so that basically means that when the earliest you can get the medium yard completed is 5 years after you arrive. But once you have the medium yard built, you can then start building dreadnoughts. Or more specifically, you can build the boom, the large booms and the large aft sections you need to construct dreadnoughts. So, and on the side of that, there's a couple of additional slipways that you can construct to allow you to build frigates, destroyers, or light cruisers. Each of those costs money, but and there's also certain points that you can unlock these features. Yes. But another key thing is that, let me see if I can bring it up in here. If you want to start building bases, a big holdup is the medium yard, because I believe it's, where is it now? Yeah, so basically, because in the Alpha Octant, in the modern Alpha Octant, I should say, by the time of the General War, the way that you build a base is that you build a mobile base, and then you pay points to build it up into a base station or a battle station and so on. In Omega, we don't know for sure, because most of the local Omega bases haven't been built yet. But for the Saltorians, what it is they have the ability in the Alpha Octant, at least, to build mobile bases. But you can only start building mobile bases after the medium shipyard is finished. So again, that means that you've got five full years, from the date you begin operations at your new colony planet before you can actually start building bases to defend it. But on the flip side, by that point, you're also able to start building dreadnoughts. So there's that kind of delayed action in terms of being able to actually construct a viable empire. So, So if we assume that the arrival point is the same as in Alpha, so Y182, that means that you're looking at Y187 before you can start building dreadnoughts, or before you can start building bases. Let's be generous enough to assume that the Sotorians figure out what a mobile base is, or something equivalent, so that they can begin the process of constructing the kind of bases that they had back in the home galaxy. That means that you've got a physically bigger fleet than you would have had in Alpha. Because the other thing as well is that if you have a host empire, the host empire has to let you build a medium shipyard. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have a host empire, then you don't have to worry about that.
Right.
So on the one hand, you've got a fleet that looks more like a traditional Sotorian fleet back in the home galaxy. But you've got no fighters unless you can hire mercenary pilots. And you've got no fast patrol ships because they don't exist in Omega until the Y190s. And you've got no X-ships either because they don't exist until the Y190s either in Omega. And also, to give you some context, by Y187, the Andromedans were trying to pick off the Vryn Nebula. So their main focus was elsewhere at that point. And the Soldier hadn't really emerged in force, except maybe to harass the Velasco and the Paravians. But in Y191, I want to say, was it Y189? So they've only got like maybe another 4 years before the Andromedans and the Soldier emerge in force in the southeast corner of Omega. So that basically means that the Saltorians only have a few more years after their medium shipyard is built before real trouble knocks on their door. So then the question would be, is that enough to give them a fighting chance, or is it not? So, yeah. And also, is that different enough
from
the Saltorians and Alphas for people who want to be interested to try it?
Right. And as always, you know, the big question is, as I pointed out last time, which is with Sartorian, you know, obviously they're going to be, you know, assuming that they arrive, but they normally arrive, you know, previously, which I think would be, is a given in my mind. And that is, given the year that they arrive, and of course, then as you pointed out, the required buildup of said Sartorian, even if they were in a non-built-up area, like let's just say around 183, you still got, you know, the soldier have not really, you know, taken over, you know, that the empty space around the galactic rim, you know, between the L'Oreal and the Redani, and of course, you know, and at the north, you know, the Alondo host. So obviously I think most of us would agree that the Sartorians would have pretty much no chance against the soldier. The soldier might just barrel them over. But in which case, the question at that point is, what do the Sartorians do? You know, do they at that point look for, you know, a host empire, you know, like the Kaligar, you know, at that point?
Don't they pretty much have to? Don't they have to hitch their star to somebody else just to give them the logistical base they need to seek out and continue their war of reciprocity against the Tholian overlords?
Yeah, I the only reason I say yes is just because of the biggest issue is going to be basically the Sartorians having to build an empire in a very short period of time. Because my guess is that the Sartorians aren't going to make that big of a difference when it comes to history until they basically run into. And of course, the question then is the Tholians, because the Tholians can make a difference. It can make a big difference because of, just plain and simple, because of the number of years that they're going to be in place before a lot of the rest of the Omega Octans actually expands. Because the Tholians come into the Alpha Octant, what, around, what, Y67? Is that right?
Yeah, that's about right.
Y79,
okay. Y79. Well,
yeah, but they don't actually reveal themselves until Y182, or sorry, Y82, rather, because fortunately for them, the Klingons didn't discover them on arrival. So they had enough time to just barely be at the beginning of settling in, and then plan the initial space grab that led to the establishment of the whole class.
Right.
So yes, basically, in this scenario, the Tholians would arrive in the same year somewhere in Omega, and that gives them a good century without any nearby empires. But it does also mean that in all that time, they're probably having to deal with the Zosman Marauders, or with the whether or not they're going to trade with the Bosco, or if they're going to let the Iridani do any kind of contact or whatever. So whether any of that stuff happens, it'll still give the Tholians something to do. Like, they won't necessarily be completely separate from the rest of the universe. But in fairness, the Paravians on the other corner of the map, they were there. The exact details hadn't been published yet, but they were there in their own corner of space for a long time, keeping their heads down. But it's all about Y170, when they basically began really expanding as an empire. And even then, the Trobin don't realize that they're there until Y175, in terms of there actually being empire to empire.
Right.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that the Tholians would be boring in the sense of, how long, because Omega is a very dynamic place.
Right.
There's lots of time periods in Omega where you have different casts of characters, so to speak. And there'll be plenty of stuff for the Tholians to do, even if it isn't until later in the timeline. before anyone else, like aside from the Zosmans or whatever, contacts them.
Right. So, well, and
I definitely think that there's.
And the question is with the Tholians, is that please correct me if I'm wrong, but they're very. I'm not gonna say xenophobic. They're not really afraid of other possible empires, or have a definite hatred of other ones, but they are definitely suspicious and very protective of themselves when it comes to, what just happened to them. They've been running for, I'm not sure how many years they were in flight from M81 to make it to the Milky Way. And so, they might run into the Zosmans, but the question is what will happen when they meet the Zosmans. Because my assumption is they're going to try to avoid contact with them, either if they can destroy them, or otherwise just try to avoid them, if possible.
Well, I suspect, because even back in the home galaxy, the Tholians made it a full-time mission to try to eliminate piracy within their home territory. Mm-hmm. But it didn't always work, so you still had the likes of the OGR, the old galaxy pirates, operating here and there. So I suspect that the same thing would apply in their... Whatever size territory they think is good enough in Omega, they'd most likely try to do their best to keep anyone else out, including the Zosman Marauders. But of course, with the stealth fields, getting rid of the Zosmans is a big challenge in and of itself. Like, it's even harder than with the Orions, because only a certain number of Orion ships have cloaking devices. But with Zosmans, all the Zosman ships have stealth fields. So rooting out their bases is a much more of a challenge. But I think it wouldn't surprise me that if the Tholians, because in Alpha, the Tholians are generally very good at playing other empires against each other.
Right. Like
the whole let's you and him fight thing. So I think it's not entirely impossible, beyond the territory that the Tholians mark as being theirs, maybe they wouldn't be entirely immune to some sort of mercenary agreement or some sort of thing where maybe information about what's happening elsewhere, or some sort of technology transfer or whatever. Maybe what they could do is there'd be some sort of like asteroid or like a planetoid that's in a star system beyond their borders, and they'll designate that as the contact point. And so if the mercenary faction shows up and places whatever they have there and then goes away again, then the Tholians might send a transport to pick that up or to trade or whatever like that. Where to something that they wouldn't necessarily be in a hurry to do back in Alpha, but in Omega, the circumstances are different enough that they might be willing to go at least that far. So, I guess that there's, I'll have to, other people might have their own ideas and so forth, and, be interesting to see what they might be. But I think even out of sheer necessity, because if there's no nearby empire that's easy for them to steal a heavy weapon from, then they're really going to have to think carefully in terms of what weapon and from where they're going to source to replace part of their cannons. Because if we assume that they make the same mistakes that they made in Alpha in terms of the particle cannon technology, then they're going to need to have some sort of recourse. And so, yeah. But actually also, if you're looking at the Y-180s, for the Tholians, they would not have PFs either, because, again, those don't exist in Alpha until the Y-190s. They wouldn't have X-ships either, but they would have fighters, because fighters are more widespread early on in Alpha, in Omega, than they are in Alpha. Fortunately, they don't have any drones. And also, when you think about it, the type of fighters that the Tholians have, they're very simple. Like, either they've got phasers, or in Alpha, they'd have, like, occasional disruptor fighters and stuff. So, presumably, if they capture a weapon system to use instead of disruptors, then they would basically put those on their fighters instead. But yeah, in terms of the actual, what the fighters look like, I'd say that it wouldn't be entirely impossible to picture them being more or less the same as what we know in Alpha.
Right. Oh, I agree there.
If we assume that the Neos show up in, yeah, and if we assume that the Neos show up in time, then you'd also assume that they get the same limited access to webcasters. So some of the webcaster variants that you see in Alpha might appear as well, but maybe not any of the war cruisers, because in Omega, the first war cruisers don't appear until Y-187. So it would probably be something similar for the Omega Tholians, in that maybe they won't get, like, the Tholian war cruiser, maybe they won't figure it out until, like, Y-190 or something. So it would be a type of unit that would appear just in time to fight the soldier in the Andromedans. So, and then if they survive that invasion, then if they can use it against the other Omega Empires afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you're looking at a Tholian fleet that by necessity is different from what you'd be familiar with in Alpha, but perhaps an interesting way. So at least I think so.
Agreed. Yeah, the one thing that the question really is in my mind when it comes to heavy weapons is, yeah, they can run into the Zosman. The Zosman might be able to sell them some heavy weapons. So obviously, you know, what they did with the disruptors, i.e. grabbed them from the Klingons and reverse engineered how they work. Because that's one thing I actually was reading up on and I was trying to prepare for today, which was Module R4J, you know, the Romulan alternate history. You know, the history, that's one thing I'd like to go over on the podcast. And one of the things is that, you know, they have to reverse engineer, which takes a while to reverse engineer it and actually produce the product. I think it's a little bit easier to produce a disruptor, you know, reverse engineer that than what the Romans would have to do in R4J, which is reverse engineer a warp drive, which is a little different, a little more difficult to do. But still, it requires some work. Now, with Zosman, obviously, you could possibly do that with heavy weapons. Not sure what kind of heavy weapons Zosman would be willing to sell them. Because obviously the big issue there is that if the Tholians were able to contact the Zosmans and actually make a broker a deal, because as you pointed out, that the Tholians hated pirates and the Zosmans could be considered pirates. And if they assumed that the Zosmans were unwilling or, you know, unwilling to sell the Tholians' weapons because of the possible use against them or other possible factors, one thing that could have been, you know, could be, in my mind, could be worked on, which is either come up with their own weapon, maybe based on web technology, you know, something like the webcaster can do,
because you're making me think of, because in the Module X2 discussions, one of the guys there was suggesting a weapon called the Web Lance, which would basically be the web fist function of the webcaster, basically split off from the webcaster proper and used as its own type of heavy weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So he was basically suggesting that maybe the Tholians, by the X2 era in Alpha, maybe they'll come up with the Web Lance as a new heavy weapon for smaller ships. So, like, instead of using a disruptor, you'd use the Web Lance instead.
Right. Yeah, Web Bolts.
I can't remember if I'm...
That's one thing.
But the only thing is that historically, the Tholians don't get access to the webcaster until the Neil show up, because, but actually, you know, here's an idea. So let's say the Tholians lose particle cannon technology as normal, and they can't get another technology to replace it. So maybe for the next few decades, all those Tholian ships are phaser boats. But let's say in this idea that the Neo show up on time, and together they work out the limited production of webcasters. So maybe then, maybe out of necessity, the Omega Tholians come up with the Web Lance, and that is basically their heavy weapon. But they don't get it until the Y-180s or something.
Right.
So how does that
Yeah, but the path I was going to go down actually was the idea of them. They have phaser technology. Why not work on, see if either like X ship phasers, you know, advanced phasers when it comes to, you know, what normally for everybody else was, you know, they finally designed in like the 190s. Finally, you know, improved it. You know, the phones could be worked, you know, out of necessity, could have been forced to actually work on improving the phaser technology, you know, and possibly I was thinking about of coming up with basically what's called mega phasers, but have it so that they were created so they could actually work on a ship.
You mean like the Borak?
Yeah.
Well, the thing is that the Borak are very kind of awkward with that, because they need to put their phaser, kind of their mega phasers, in turrets, because the mega phasers themselves use smaller firing arcs.
Mm-hmm.
So they do have a phaser cannon, which basically each phaser cannon lets you fire three phaser two shots. But here's another idea. So someone in the thread was basically saying, well, what would have happened if instead of going to Omega proper, the sphere had headed towards the Eridani cluster? And so I was looking at the year in service dates for Eridani ships, and they hadn't quite built their heavy cruisers yet, the Galleons, but they did have their light cruisers. So they probably wouldn't have had very many of them, but they might have had enough. Like if the Tholians were on approach, and if we assume that a big giant sphere heading towards the cluster is detectable at some range, because there's no barrier around the cluster, so maybe it'd be easier to see what's coming in, except for the Andromedans, that is, because the Andromedans are a different case. But in this circumstance, let's say if the Eridani build up a force, scramble together enough ships to give the Tholians pause for thought, because the Tholians, you know, they need time to establish themselves anyway. And maybe instead of attacking each other, they cut a deal where basically the Eridani hand over these star charts saying, look, there's this whole big bunch of empty space in Omega that you can use. Oh, and by the way, watch out for the galactic barrier. It's quite strong. And in game,
yeah, we know.
We will give you.
Boy, that's yeah. A British level of understatement.
Okay, so
sorry, in exchange, Gary.
Here is the rules. Okay, here's the reverse engineering method for our heavy weapon, which is called the focus energy beam. It's kind of like a big phaser. But it has a 32 impulse firing delay. And also, here are the templates for new civilian craft, because remember, the Tholians show up in the galaxy historically with no freighters, because the old freighters that they had back in the home galaxy were used by their subjugated species. The Tholians in M81 hadn't bothered using freighters for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
So they, historically speaking, they had to basically steal Klingon freighters and figure out how to use them themselves. So in this situation, the Eridani might say, all right, well, these templates, which we ourselves just got from other species a few years ago, they work for a variety of species. We know that. So they'll work for you, but we'll give them to you after you leave. So they're basically, you know, they'll say that, okay, once you arrive, once you cross the barrier and you decide that you're going to establish your empire in Omega, tell us where your provisional borders are going to be. And then we'll show up with a ship just beyond those borders, at like an asteroid or something, like I was saying earlier. And we'll leave you the templates for these freighters. And, you know, we'll give you, some, like, the most recent political information we have from Omega. And you can then take that information and do what you like. But you have to not try to invade our home planet. So, will the Tholians take that deal? If they didn't, then they could fight the Iridani for control of the cluster. But that would probably leave them with, like, if they, even if they won, they'd be in a very precarious situation, depending on how many ships they lost.
Right.
Because we're not talking about more early years.
That is an interesting idea, because effectively what you're talking about is the Starfleet Universe Omega Octant Quadrant version of Danegeld. Because once you start, the problem is once you start paying the Danegeld, you never get rid of them.
Yeah.
Well, possibly. But the thing would be is that once the Tholian, in this circumstance, once the Tholians agree, if they agree, to turn the sphere around and go into Omega, even if it's they're better prepared to go through the barrier, you could still say that the engines of the sphere take a certain amount of damage, so they're not going anywhere again. So they're committed to being in Omega. Right. So that still doesn't let the Iridani off the hook, because that basically means that the Iridani in this timeline are going to be more heavily fortifying their home cluster than they did historically. So ironically, they'd be more prepared for the Andromedans when they showed. But it does basically mean that one of the prices that the price the Iridani would have to pay in order to not, in order to basically just, show an abundance of caution, which doesn't really sound very Iridani because they're very gung-ho, but let's just say in this circumstance that the king decides that it's prudent to do so, that maybe they become the ones that, have the agreements where they provide information about what else is happening on Omega to the, they're more politically acceptable to the Tholians than the Zosmans would be, because the Zosmans have more of a reputation of being quote-unquote pirates, whereas the Iridani, yes, a quest knight can do piratical things if the mission of the quest says so. And they maybe, if they're acting as a mercenary, the empire that they're mercenarying for might say, go on an objective raid, and that looks a lot like piracy. It's piracy with government package, privateering, basically. But there's still enough of a line between that where it might be more acceptable for the Tholians to use them indirectly, the Iridani rather, in this circumstance. So, but yeah, that basically means that, tactically speaking, you'd be thinking about, well, what would Tholian ships look like if they had the focused energy beam? I should say that the focused energy beam, it can already be used by the Zosmans. It's not a common weapon for them, because one of the things as well is that the Iridani themselves have a support system called the Sargon Illuminator. And no other empire can use that because it's tied into the Iridani fire control system.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing about the Illuminator is that it modifies the die roll for any wide-angle phasers or feb shots being fired at a single target that's illuminated. Now, the Tholians wouldn't have that, so you'd have to basically sit down and check out the weapons, the damage chart and the to-hit chart for the feb, the unboosted feb. Kind of like the way, like, if you had a disruptor with no UIM and no Durfax, is that enough for the Tholians to get by with?
It's an interesting question.
Do you have the Omega Master Rulebook on your computer there, Paul?
Yeah, I should. There it is. Come on, bring it up.
Yeah, so if you want, if you want to bring it up, just have a look for the focused energy beam and have a look at the stats and see what you think.
Okay, focused energy beams. Okay, da-da-da-da. There it is. Okay, let me let people see that. Let's move this a little bit over to here. That is, you know, 2d6. Pretty much it's, obviously it's good, it can fire, it can actually do some damage all the way out to range 32, but even then that's going to be slim pickings.
Looks like it's good range is the Klingon saber fighting 9 to 14 zone. If you get anything closer to that, then yeah, you still have the possibility of coming up with nothing, but you can, you start getting to the point where you're hurting harder than standard photons.
Okay, but also requires 3 points of energy to charge it. It's always
more. I'm trying to remember if the SFB version lets you use the phaser capacitor to charge it or not, because there is a playtest version of the weapon in Fed Commander, but of course in FC there's no such thing as a phaser capacitor, so you just arm it as normal. But in SFB, it should say in there somewhere which sources of energy you can use for it.
Yeah, it doesn't say in the SFB if there's a, give me a look. Pretty sure there wasn't a particular energy source. Source of energy, the energy used to arm a focused energy beam can come from any source and could be allocated or reserved power. Focused energy beams can draw energy from phaser capacitors if needed. Exception is H61. I have to look, see what that is. That's definitely a reserved power usage section. Although the size of the phaser capacitor is not increased by the presence of the Feb boxes on the ship, if energy is drawn from the phaser capacitor system, reserve power can be allocated to the system on the same turn, but not the same impulse to fire phasers. The reverse also is possible. After power is removed from by firing phasers, reserve power can be applied to the capacitor to fire Febs. Focus energy beams.
Yeah, and another thing as well is that Febs can be used on fighters as well. Now, the Iridani, they're smaller fighters. They're too small for a target illuminator. So some of them are just phaser boats, and others, I think, have a Feb as a heavy weapon. But they do have a heavy fighter that has a built-in target illuminator. Now, again, the illuminator wouldn't be a factor for the Thorians, or for that matter, for those Osnan Marauders. So, but in any case, it, even for the Iridani, I guess the point is that their size one fighters, the ones that have Febs, have to make do without the illuminator. So they're just using the Feb as a standard fighter weapon. So that would basically be the template that the Tholians in this contingency would be going with.
Yeah,
if you think about it, the Tholians tend to have a lot of phasers anyway. So I guess if they wanted to have the option of using the capacitor to top up their Feb fire, then they could do that.
Right, which is why I was going down the road of, you know, let's say that they didn't get, you know, if they actually end up in Omega, they didn't get heavy weapons, but tried to produce a heavier version of the phaser, because physics technology they could produce, and therefore, in my mind, they could actually research and possibly improve. If basically, you know, the rubber hits the road, you know, that they are in such a dire straits for a heavier weapon than just phasers, you know, that their whole existence is, you know, is up for grabs, you know, and that's not exactly a position that they want to be in.
No.
Well, the problem with that is that because Tholian phasers can fire through their own webs, but Tholian heavy weapons can't. It might be a bit imbalancing if you give Tholian ships mega phasers and then let them fire through their own webs too, because right now, the only time that you have a heavier phaser that you have to worry about is if you're attacking a Tholian base, because they can have phaser force. But if you're giving the Tholians the capacity in open space to fire through web with like a heavier phaser like weapon, that might be a problem. That might be a potentially imbalancing issue.
Yeah, but at the same time,
one thing with the Feb at least is that it's a heavier phaser-ish weapon, but it is blocked by web. So just as the case with disruptors and photons, mm-hmm. the Tholians would have to exercise a certain degree of caution in terms of when they're firing it.
Well, but at the same time, that could be easily explained away that if the Tholians actually produced a heavier phaser, I mean, like a mega phaser kind of thing, in that they could say, well, to have part of the reason why the Tholians can fire the phasers through the webs is because they can tune the frequency of the phasers to the what the web is using. But the problem is they lost that part of the mega phaser. They lost the ability to tune the frequency of the phaser to get the additional amount of damage. You know, the different mega is more destructive. You know, they lost the ability to tune it, in which case it can't fire through Tholian webs. You know, so I think that could, in theory, you know, that kind of thing could easily be explained away and still keep the overall balance when it comes to using heavier weapons by the Tholians.
Of course, that brings up a very, very, very scary thought. What happens if the Tholians grab their hands on the technology to build both mega phasers and the turrets they ride in?
Well, that would be actually.
Yeah, well, the other side is the form follows function thing. You would expect them to actually be able to do that. It's just a matter of scale. Just a radical thought, but how about if you're sticking these guys into that particular area, why not just say, hey, they actually managed to maintain the data for their old heavy weapons, their old Via Galaxy stuff, and they can just start manufacturing it then. I mean, it's not exactly an unbalancing thing, because if you think about it, in the first decade or so of the SFB universe, you know, they're restricted in their weaponry, but this is prior to, you know, the add-on creation of the Tholian old galaxy stuff, that where the one squadron shows up and they've got access to all the old tech. So if you're dropping them in a different place with a different set of circumstances, maybe they could have a better starting a capability than they did in the traditional SFB galaxy, mm-hmm.
which
would basically take away a lot of this problems of tech development.
Oh, agreed.
And put you into more of a position of how do they carve out their space for themselves, mm-hmm. once they're there.
Yeah, and also that would explain why they entered in to the Omega Octant instead of the Alpha Octant, because they first possibly attempted and realized it's going to take too much, we're going to burn systems out, and they flew over around the Milky Way and went, hey, we see an easier spot, you know, that's not as thick over here, you know, the Alpha Octant, in which case, you know, they were able to retain those data banks that had the designs for building the patrol, particle cannons. Did I have that right? That they got burned out, or was that the one of the ones that got locked up and they couldn't unlock it?
So,
it doesn't matter. Did you ever have it?
Well, part of the issue is, historically anyway, at least based on the more recent like Monster Starship book kind of stuff is that done earlier stuff, I should say. When they first crashed through the barrier, they still had the data banks for how to build webcasters and how to build particle cannons. The problem is that the military officers who had the command codes needed to unlock those files were either dead because they died during going through the barrier, or they had never been on those ships because they were still back in the home galaxy. Like, because there's a thing about how the last group of ships that were bigger than a destroyer were basically left. They were doing a holding action, fighting the Sultorians to prevent the Sultorians from reaching the sphere before it skedaddled from M81. So what happened historically is that I guess they felt pressured enough by the Klingons to try to hack into the particle cannon files. And by doing that, they triggered a catastrophic reaction. And so the server basically melted down. And so that's why they didn't touch the webcaster files until the admiral in charge of the Neo expedition turned over the key and said, here we go. So yes, actually, you know what? That's a possibility. Maybe, let's say, for argument's sake, that they go through the barrier directly, so they don't go to the Eridani first. They crash into Omega, but they still have the same data banks. But there are no Klingons. So they've got a few thousand parsecs in either direction where there's no one else to bother them.
Right.
So, and also, they don't have the attrition, because the one reason why they needed to replace the particle cannon in the first place is because the Klingons were blowing up the ship that had them. But in this case, they're not. So maybe it's not as big of a panic to replace the particle cannon.
Right, so they could reverse engineer their own systems.
Yeah. Well, actually, what I would say is this. Let's say that they have the files, but they don't try to hack them, because say they're prudent enough to decide that the panic, the emergency is not there. So but then by the time the Neo show up in the Y-170s, the same again, the Admiral says, here's the command key. So by the late Y-170s, they're building particle cannons. So again, that's not necessarily too big a deal, because maybe by the time other empires realize the Thorians are there, it's close to that time period anyway. So from the perspective of other empires, like the Alumda or the Kolagar or whatever, the Thorians use particle cannons. But what we know in domestically, or perhaps in terms of being attacked by the Thousand Waters, they don't have the particle cannons except on those Neo frigates and destroyers that they had with them. But it's not a panic. So maybe they're just using phasers or whatever to try to ward off pirates or whatever like that. But they're not necessarily too worried about it until the Neo show up and help them. So yes, if you decide that you want to go about it and say, hey, just use particle cannons, I suppose there's a way you could do it. If you don't mind pushing the introduction of the particle cannon back to like the mid to late Y-170s, which I don't think would be a deal breaker. So yeah, if you want to avoid the entire issue of... But the thing is, though, is that part of the fun, I guess, of putting the Tholians in Omega from a tactical perspective would be to see, we know what Tholians look like with particle cannons. And we know what they look like with disruptors and with photons. But if you give the Tholians an Omega heavy weapon, is it more or less interesting than those options are? So it's basically giving the player the opportunity to try something different that wouldn't necessarily be on the table in another part of the universe. So I wouldn't necessarily be in too much of a hurry to skip that option. But again, module R4J has 5 alternate timelines. So it's quite possible that you could do as many timelines here and say, there's a timeline where they keep particle cannons. There's a timeline where they get the focused energy beam. There's a timeline where they get maybe the tachyon gun, or they get the antimatter cannon, which is another 32 impulse weapon. And you don't have to do much with the SSEs. You can, because people can just look up the Omega Master Roadbook and see what the stats are. Basically, I think there's different ways to slice it. But hopefully, the sum total of all that would be a faction that would be interesting enough for people to want to actually play, either tactically or maybe strategically as well.
Agreed. Well, that's
certainly an interesting idea.
Oh, agreed. Overall, you know, the Tholians ending up in the Omega Octant is an interesting idea, just because of the year that they ended up in the Milky Way. So it's not like they end up later on, where especially in the Alpha Octant, that, you know, all of the space in all the territory within the Alpha Octant was kind of explored to a certain degree, or at least claimed by different empires. You know, there was still quite a bit of untamed territory. In which case, in my mind, that this makes it open that, you know, people really didn't feel like, okay, you know, yeah, that's mine. It's like, no, that's unknown space, and we don't know what's there, so we can't claim it as our own. You know, because soon we claim it, then we have to protect it, that kind of thing.
Right.
So I think, you know, that. I think that, you know, having the Tholians end up in the Mega Octant is just, it's a very intriguing idea, just because of that, because it gives them, you know, a very different view of the galaxy, you know, because especially if they land someplace where there is no empire at all, you know, as I said, between the L'Oreal and the Auradani right there, where it's pretty much undeveloped, you know, no one knows about anyone existing in that space, that, you know, they could end up there and just flourishing, you know, building up their bases, building up their infrastructure to protect themselves. And I can't imagine the Tholians actually want to be, you know, take up that much, you know, territory, you know, though obviously it would depend upon what their needs were, you know. How much do they think economically do they think they would need to actually keep, you know, be able to protect themselves, basically? And then, of course, then later, you know, 100 years later, the Sartorians show up. More than 100 years, but you got the idea. You know, and the question is, at that point, do they find the Tholians immediately, or do, in which case, they, at that point, you know, given that the Tholians might have no one to fight against them, which could be bad or good for the Tholians, you know, could be good in that there could be rampant, you know, expansions into that territory, or it could be bad because they have no one to push them, no one to force them to innovate to the degree that they have to build out the territory, you know, build out their economic base, so that they can support the protecting themselves against a violent universe.
That leads to one final point, because we are getting late. I don't want to take more of your time tonight. But if you think, okay, so historically, the Tholians and the Sartorians, when they arrived in the Alpha Octant, they didn't know about things like T-bombs. And they didn't know about suicide shuttles. And they didn't know about other things that are considered to be the norm, I guess, so to speak, in this galaxy, in Alpha or Omega, for that matter. So it might be something similar here, where when the Tholians arrive, if they don't contact anyone for a few decades, then they would still basically be going around with no T-bombs until maybe they encounter a pirate or ship or a in the Iridani Questor or something like that. And then they start, you know, dropping all these transporter bombs, and they're thinking, well, do we need those as well? And actually for the Sartorians, you've got two options. You've got either when the Sartorians come through, they eventually, if they encounter the Tholians or someone else who figure all this out, then they adopt them in turn. Or if the Sartorians get infected by the Sigvirians, well, the Sigvirians will already know what a T-bomb is. So they'll start producing them right away. But there'd still be a certain limit in terms of the capacity that the Sigvirians would know, because even if the Sigvirians know what a carrier is, they wouldn't necessarily be able to use their Sultorian hosts to fly them. So they might have to wait until they can recruit mercenary pilots to do the flying for them, which might take some time, whatever. So, but yeah, so basically there's like the technology issues and so forth, like just the kind of more the assumptions that you'd have. Like, so say, for example, if you did the first contact scenario for either empire, you could basically have the rules be that the Tholian or Sartorian ship still has to use the M81 galaxy restrictions, whereas the empire that they're fighting doesn't. And then maybe by the second or third battle, the other guys can. Like, they figured out, oh, this is what a T-bomb is and so on.
Right.
So it'd almost be like having one player has to play Federation Commander rules where there's no such thing as T-bombs. And then the other one's playing SFB rules where there are. So
Right. That
might be interesting too, you know, like, you know, if you've got web technology, then if you're looking at a T-bomb, are you as excited? Or is that something that you kind of have to figure out if you actually want to bother using or not?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, with tactical implications to having a T-bomb, especially given that I'm sure that one of the reasons why, you know, the Tholians and the Sartorians didn't know about T-bombs, it's like, okay, what's... They really wasn't seeking weapons, you know? And without
here's another thought for you. Why not go back to the tech tree thing? Let them develop tech using the tech tree. You remember that thing from way back when?
Yeah, from the campaign designer's manual handbook.
Yeah.
CDH.
Yeah, just use that and let them, you know, for instance, if they start encountering all the other races in the Omega Quadrant, maybe they could use survey ships to gather scientific knowledge as a, you know, basis for them developing weapons and reverse engineering what they're being shot with.
Mm-hmm.
Without necessarily capturing any. And if they capture a ship, well, good Lord, the thing's practically a blueprint for you then. You don't have to reverse engineer something you already have that works.
Right. Well, at the same time, if you capture something, the reason why you reverse engineer it is so that you can then build it yourself. Versus just seeing the output of
You're also talking about, you know, a civilization with the level of technology that they could literally just scan the whole thing and say, oh, that's how that works. If they have an intact working disruptor, for instance. Now, if all the weapons are destroyed and they have to fix them, well, that could be a thing for reverse engineering. But, you know, it's like if we had a... Chinese fighter jet land in Los Angeles tomorrow, we wouldn't have to reverse engineer how it works. We could literally just 3D scan the entire thing and all the parts and do a little bit of metallurgical analysis, and it won't take much because we already have that similar knowledge and, you know, the ability to make stuff like that. So I couldn't really see the Tholians being completely deprived of that if they're able to repair their ships, if they're able to build new, you know, parts for their ships. So, but that was a thought that just kind of popped in. Why not use the campaign setup? It's already in existence for them to figure out how to make particle cannons if you don't let them have it already. I mean, because that whole thing about why they don't have all the old tech stuff is just kind of a, you know, big MacGuffin plot cover up for the fact that they weren't built that way from the beginning in the product line. So
there is that.
There's that. You know.
Not to mention and the fact that there, probably the reason if, for if, the MacGuffin in the first designing place was an alternate balance. Thing,
and if you're designing an alternate universe thing, there's absolutely no reason why you can't just say, well, there you go. Boink. We're going to try that. And then you play test it out and see how it goes. Okay, that was my two cents right there.
Okay, well,
and
we got
2 cents it was.
Yep, we got to wrap up because it's already 11 o'clock and I got to get my ass to bed sometime before midnight.
Well, hey, just to keep you up even longer then. Gamers of Summer, plug, plug, plug. Coming up, plug, plug, plug. I need some, like, I don't know, events to list.
Yeah, I know. I can't
fall.
I know. I got to work on that. I got so many things to work on. It's insane.
And you know, I was speaking with Barry the other day. He's very interested in the idea of a tournament.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had to explain to him, though, that it probably would not include any of the Omega stuff, even if they are playtesty approvy things, because the vast majority of players that might come out for tournaments, I don't know if they would want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, or compete against something they've never seen. So there's that.
Understood.
So, okay, that was it. That was my big thing there. So,
okay.
Here's your bees.
Well, okay. With that, I'll let Doug be muted. Yeah. It's always a pleasure to have you around and hanging out with.
Good evening, everybody.
You have a good night.
I'll do that.
Gary. Always interesting to have you around. It's always a pleasure. So
if you're going to Games this summer, don't forget to bring those captain's logs so you can show, if Barry shows up, you can show him the Paravians of Omega and those Osmond Marauders as well.
We'll do. Okay, well, Gary, you have a good night.
Good night. Okay.
So, interesting way of starting things out. Yes, this is this week in cricket in the U.S. So starts with that, and we finally get around to the discussion of, which is always interesting and fascinating, idea of the Tholians actually ending up in the Omega Octant. Because overall, you know, there's so many possibilities that it opens up. So many possibilities that come into focus, you know, because of, you know, if we keep it with the main timeline of them coming to, you know, Milky Way galaxy, and the same thing happened to them as they're crossing the barrier, you know, and they lose, you know, technology and lose people to the degree that they did, you know, there's still a great number of possibilities of, okay, let's say that where they end up, obviously, depending upon where they actually, quote unquote, landed, that could mean a lot of different things. You know, obviously the most, in my mind, the most advantageous ones where there's nobody there. Versus if there's already someone there, then you might have to fight your way and hopefully, you know, fight your way into a little spot where, you know, you can survive. Or, you know, if you land into a place where it's already occupied, then you might just be dead, you know. So anyway, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.